From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I will soon submit to Congress a request for $87 billion. The request will cover ongoing military and intelligence operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere.
President Bush is in crisis. He's slipping in the polls. He needs money and he needs troops. He's authorized Colin Powell to go where the U.S. did not succeed before, the U.N. Security Council, and ask for a U.S.-led multinational force in Iraq. We'll get reaction from the Kurds. We'll get reaction from Pakistan and from India.
Bush's attempt to rope in India into Iraq is unlikely to work because the Indian public opinion is strongly against that.
And a discussion about the resignation of the Palestinian Prime Minister, Abu Mazen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a nationally televised primetime address last night, President Bush said he would ask Congress for $87 billion in emergency spending for military operations and reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that Iraq had now become what he called the central front in the campaign against terrorism. The speech was Bush's first from the White House since he announced the bombing of Baghdad on March 19th. He omitted any mention of how long U.S. troops would remain in Iraq, how much the operation will ultimately cost, and the administration's failure to find any weapons of mass destruction. Citing Defense Department figures, USA Today is reporting that the monthly bill for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan now rival the Pentagon's average monthly spending during Vietnam. That tab doesn't include reconstruction costs. Meanwhile, the latest Zogby America poll says that President Bush has dropped to the lowest approval ratings of his presidency. The poll says 54% of Americans rated Bush's performance as fair or poor. Only 40% said he deserved to be reelected. Zogby America says Bush's popularity has been on a steady decline since a post-September 11th peak. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat nominated the Speaker of the Parliament as Prime Minister to replace Mahmoud Abbas, who resigned Saturday after just 4 months in office. Ahmed Correa was an architect of the 1993 Oslo Peace Accords. He was accepted by top representatives of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Fatah political movement as Arafat's nominee to fill the position and attempt to quell a mounting political crisis. Saeb Erekat, a Palestinian legislator and chief negotiator with Israel and the United States, said Arafat nominated Correa today after Abbas, quote, made a very public statement saying his resignation was final. Correa does not have a wide base of popular support among Palestinians, though he has been an elected member of the Palestinian Legislative Council from Jerusalem since 1996. He also previously served as economy and trade minister and industry minister for the Palestinian Authority. Correa was bypassed earlier this year when U.S., European, U.N., and Russian representatives pushed Arafat to accept Abbas. Israeli officials have already indicated they may protest the appointment, saying he's too closely associated with Arafat. Meanwhile, the spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, has vowed to avenge Israel's attack on Gaza over the weekend that wounded him and 14 others. On Saturday, an Israeli F-16 dropped a quarter-ton bomb on a Gaza neighborhood. About 3,000 students marched in Gaza City yesterday in support of the sheikh. Hamas vowed revenge for the attack and said that Israel had opened the gates of hell. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon warned Hamas leaders are now marked for death. Israel sealed off the West Bank and Gaza Strip overnight. The Drudge Report says another African-American bodybuilder has come forward claiming California gubernatorial candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger has a history of making racist comments. Robbie Robinson, one of the most respected and well-known of all bodybuilders, a former Mr. America, Mr. World, and Mr. Universe title holder, backs up claims made by fellow black bodybuilder Rick Wayne. Robinson says that Schwarzenegger repeatedly directed the term nigger at him. The only videotape known to have captured both planes slamming into the World Trade Center, and only the second image of the first strike, has surfaced days before the second anniversary of the September 11, 2001 attacks. The footage, obtained by the New York Times, was taken by a Czech immigrant construction worker who's at one point came close to accidentally erasing the rare chilling footage. Federal officials investigating the Trade Center collapse are trying to obtain a copy of the hour-long tape, which could cast light on the cause of the North Tower's collapse by helping to determine factors including the exact speed at which the first plane traveled. The only other known footage of the first plane's impact came from a French film crew making a documentary about a probationary firefighter. And the New York Times is reporting that more than a third of the emergency grant money intended to help small businesses in Lower Manhattan survive after the September 11th attacks went to investment firms, financial traders, and lawyers, a result that some New York legislators who helped secure money for the program say they never envisioned.
Bangladesh, 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 Bangladesh. When the sun sinks in the west, die a million people of the Nation stand, would say to sacrifice a people for a land. Bangladesh, 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 Bangladesh. When the sun sinks in the
Song of Bangladesh, Joan Baez, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. The latest Zogby poll says President Bush has dropped to the lowest approval ratings of his presidency. Polls say 54% of Americans rated Bush's performance as fair or poor. Only 40% said he deserved to be reelected. Zogby America says Bush's popularity has been on a steady decline since the post-September 11th peak. Last night, President Bush gave a nationally televised primetime address. He said he'll ask Congress for $87 billion in emergency spending for military operations and reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that Iraq has now become what he called the central front in the campaign against terrorism. We'll hear a clip of his address.
2 years ago, I told the Congress and the country that the war on terror would be a lengthy war, a different kind of war, fought on many fronts, in many places. Iraq is now the central front. Enemies of freedom are making a desperate stand there, and there they must be defeated. This will take time and require sacrifice. Yet we will do what is necessary. We will spend what is necessary to achieve this essential victory in the war on terror, to promote freedom, and to make our own nation more secure. America has done this kind of work before. Following World War II, we lifted up the defeated nations of Japan and Germany and stood with them as they built representative governments. We committed years and resources to this cause. And that effort has been repaid many times over in three generations of friendship and peace. America today accepts the challenge of helping Iraq in the same spirit, for their sake and our own. Our strategy in Iraq has three objectives: destroying the terrorists, enlisting the support of other nations for a free Iraq, and helping Iraqis assume responsibility for their own defense and their own future. First, we are taking direct action against the terrorists in the Iraqi theater, which is the surest way to prevent future attacks on coalition forces and the Iraqi people. We are staying on the offensive with a series of precise strikes against enemy targets, increasingly guided by intelligence given to us by Iraqi citizens. Since the end of major combat operations, we have conducted raids, seizing many caches of enemy weapons and massive amounts of ammunition, and we have captured or killed hundreds of Saddam loyalists and terrorists. So far, of the 55 most wanted former Iraqi leaders, 42 are dead or in custody. We're sending a clear message. Anyone who seeks to harm our soldiers can know that our soldiers are hunting for them. Second, we are committed to expanding international cooperation in the reconstruction and security of Iraq, just as we are in Afghanistan. Our military commanders in Iraq advise me that the current number of American troops, nearly 130,000, is appropriate to their mission. They are joined by over 20,000 service members from 29 other countries. Two multinational divisions, led by the British and the Poles, are serving alongside our forces. And in order to share the burden more broadly, our commanders have requested a third multinational division to serve in Iraq. Some countries have requested an explicit authorization of the United Nations Security Council before committing troops to Iraq. I have directed Secretary of State Colin Powell to introduce a new Security Council resolution, which would authorize the creation of a multinational force in Iraq to be led by America. I recognize that not all our friends agreed with our decision to enforce the Security Council resolutions and remove Saddam Hussein from power. Yet we cannot let past differences interfere with present duties. Terrorists in Iraq have attacked representatives of the civilized world, and opposing them must be the cause of the civilized world. Members of the United Nations now have an opportunity and the responsibility to assume a broader role in assuring that Iraq becomes a free and democratic nation. Third, we are encouraging the orderly transfer of sovereignty and authority to the Iraqi people. Our coalition came to Iraq as liberators, and we will depart as liberators. Right now, Iraq has its own governing council, comprised of 25 leaders representing Iraq's diverse people. The governing council recently appointed cabinet ministers to run government departments. Already, more than 90% of towns and cities have functioning local governments, which are restoring basic services. We are helping to train civil defense forces to keep order, and an Iraqi police service to enforce the law, a facilities protection service, Iraqi border guards to help secure the borders, and a new Iraqi army. In all these roles, there are now some 60,000 Iraqi citizens under arms, defending the security of their own country, and we are accelerating the training of more. Iraq is ready to take the next steps towards self-government. The Security Council resolution we introduce will encourage Iraq's Governing Council to submit a plan and a timetable for the drafting of a constitution and for free elections. From the outset, I have expressed confidence in the ability of the Iraqi people to govern themselves. Now they must rise to the responsibilities of a free people and secure the blessings of their own liberty.
That is President Bush speaking last night, asking Congress for $87 billion in emergency spending for military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also saying that he has authorized Secretary of State Colin Powell to introduce a new Security Council resolution authorizing the creation of a multinational force led by the United States in Iraq. We turn first to Iraq, to Baghdad, where Michael Birmingham is standing by. He is with Voices in the Wilderness and has been in Iraq for close to 2 years. Welcome to Democracy Now, Michael.
How are you doing, Amy?
Good. Can you talk about reaction to President Bush's speech and the issue of the U.S. going back to the U.N. Security Council, where it was previously rebuffed, to get authorization for a multinational force led by the U.S.?
Well, as of now, I haven't had much of a sense of what Iraqi people are going to say about exactly, you know, what Bush said last night, because, of course, most people here still don't have access to anything other than a kind of an American PR television station, which has been set up in Iraq. Some people who have a little bit of money have satellite dishes. So people haven't, I don't think a lot of people have heard it, and I'm pretty sure from the reaction of those who have by the radio that it's mostly incredible cynicism. You know, people don't generally speak, and I think put much trust in the words of President Bush. I think one thing that's probably significant is for Iraqis here in terms of their reaction will be the breakdown of the money. As you can see, about $70 billion of the money that's going between Afghanistan and Iraq is going to Iraq. $50 billion of it is going to be direct military spending. Of the $20 billion that they've described as money for reconstruction in Iraq, $5 billion of that is for the army, which again, as you can figure out, is and the police is rearming them, is more military spending. So what you've got left then is $15 billion, which is coincidentally about the same, not almost exactly the same amount of money as came in under the Isle for Food program, except this is for all of Iraq's needs. And, you know, so that's what's going to be spent, they're saying, on electricity, on water, on medicines, and on basically people's salaries and keeping people alive, on food, just $15 billion.
Michael Birmingham, Donald Rumsfeld was in Iraq this weekend, and in response to people's concerns about electricity, he said that Iraq was, or Baghdad, was lit up like Chicago.
Yeah, I heard you had a blast in Chicago, in the United States recently. You know, these statements have been made consistently by Paul Bremer. In fact, every time he goes to the United States and every time he has a press conference here in Baghdad, he says that things are not bad. The main issues are being dealt with: electricity, security, jobs. Bremer said alongside Bush a few days ago that there was no chaos in Iraq, no chaos in Baghdad. You know, this plays well to people who are not getting informed by the mainstream press about what's going on in Iraq. for Iraqis, you cannot imagine how angry it makes them feel when they hear somebody, when they hear Rumsfeld say that. Baghdad has got an incredibly big problem with electricity consistently since the war.
Michael, let me ask something.
Yeah,
before we lose you and your phone line is breaking up, you've been traveling in the country, in the north, as well as other places. We're going to speak with a representative of a Kurdish organization in a minute. But can you talk about the issue of a U.S.-led multinational force of bringing other troops in from other places like India, like Turkey, like Pakistan?
You've got to remember that people on the ground here are not buying the kind of nonsense that has been put out by the administration and the lies. They live with the security situation here, and they see, and they are very angry. They see that the U.S. Administration has put nothing into actually making their dealing with the core issues they're concerned about, mainly lack of security, lack of money, lack of jobs, lack of electricity. They are very, very angry. They see American troops going around here all the time with their fingers on the trigger of 50 caliber submachine guns. That's the way they go around the city all of the time. And I went down to Hilla recently where the Poles, as you heard President Bush, he said Poland is leading one of the other international contingents along with Britain. In Hilla where Poland is leading, people are saying they will fight the Poles. They see them as simply doing the dirty work of America. And it doesn't address any of the people's problems here. They are poor. They continue to die as a result of American-led sanctions. And they are becoming increasingly angry with an occupation that is bringing them nothing but kidnappings and violence and fear and incredibly increased poverty. And it's too little, too late. And really what this is just another PR exercise. One PR exercise after another for 5 months, aiming to play to an American audience that's ill-informed, while the people of Iraq as a whole become increasingly angry. And they will become angry with the new multinational forces, but they will see them as nothing more than stooges of the United States.
And Turkish troops?
Sorry, you're talking about the Kurdish areas?
Yes, in what Turkish troops mean there, what people are saying there, and then we'll go to our Kurdish representative.
Okay, well, you know, the situation in Kurdistan has been different, of course, for the last 12 years, pretty well. Kurdistan has been more of an autonomous, not under the control of the Iraqi government. So, I guess there's an ongoing fear. You've got to remember that the Kurds came very, very close to being completely sold out by the Bush administration. They tried to spend $30 billion to bribe Turkey to come into Kurdistan, which would have been a disaster for the Kurds. And, unprecedented, courageous move of the Turkish parliament, that didn't happen. So the Kurds, I guess, many of them probably see that they got away by the skin of their noses. They're now involved on a governing council. One of the members of the governing council has already been murdered. The others have been threatened. The two main Kurdish groups, the PUK and the KDP, are part of that. It is a deeply resented, construct of the U.S. administration here, this governing council, and the Kurds are stuck right in the middle of it. But they are also going to have difficulties. One interesting point. Someone I was talking to from Fallujah was saying the Turks there's a suggestion that Turkish troops would be sent to Fallujah, where the U.S. have had great problems. They said in Fallujah they fought the Turks under Ottoman rule for a couple of hundred years, and they would welcome the opportunity to fight them again. You know, this is no solution.
Michael Birmingham, I want to thank you for being with us. Michael Birmingham of Voices in the Wilderness speaking to us from Baghdad. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with a representative of a Kurdish group, and then we'll go to India. Indian troops, the Indian government has said in the past that if there was UN authorization, a UN resolution, that they would send troops. We'll have a debate on that issue in India. We'll also be looking at the resignation of Mahmoud Abbas, the Prime Minister of Palestine. Stay with us. listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to Kani Shulam, who is executive director of the American Kurdish Information Network in Washington, D.C. Kani, your response to President Bush's speech last night and his saying that he is authorizing Colin Powell to go to the U.N. to seek a Security Council resolution authorizing a multinational force in Iraq.
My response, like the realism part of it, I guess, the fact that he finally realized the U.S. cannot do it alone, and reaching out to other members of the United Nations to help out, bring some stability to Iraq. The part about authorizing Colin Powell to get that going, there's an emphasis on, or there's some people in the United States government to who want to have the Turkish component in Iraq, some 10,000 troops. A lot of talk has been made about that. And it's a problem. The Kurds don't want the Turkish presence in Iraq. They have to cross the Kurdish territory. Just last July, some 11 Turkish special forces were captured by the U.S. troops, hooded and then interrogated. It caused a major friction between two NATO members. And Turkish-Kurdish relations go back to some, hundreds of years. In the last 200 years or in the last 80 years, it's have been more pronounced. In the last 80 years, Turkey has literally banned the Kurdish language, banned the Kurdish culture. There's this culture of intolerance in the Middle East towards the Kurds. It's just not it's not manifesting itself just by the Turks, but the Arabs are doing it the same. So have the Persians. So that's the problem. The Turkish presence in central or southern Iraq may be wanted by the U.S. government, but the Kurds don't want it. They have already said they oppose it. The newly elected or appointed foreign minister of Iraq is a Kurd. He has said that given the Turkmen, the small Turkish minority that is in Iraq, their collusion with the Turkish government to ask for more rights more than their numbers warrant have become issues that could flare up and bring more instability as opposed to stability to the region.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Kani Shulam, Executive Director of the American Kurdish Information Network. You're going to be at one of the 9-1-1 demonstrations on Thursday in Washington, D.C. at DuPont Circle. What do you plan to say there?
The rally is about the lies, 9-1-1, and the war on Iraq. I want to say the Kurdish side of the story. I want to remind the people there that when President Bush took the oath of office, he said that U.S. was a slave-owning society that became a servant of freedom. And if that's the case, the Kurds in Iraq, more than anybody else, need freedom, need liberty, and that he should fulfill his promise to the United Nations, to the U.S. government, to the United States citizens.
Kani Shulam, thanks very much for being with us. Kani Shulam is executive director of the American Kurdish Information Network. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn to India, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon begins a three-day state visit to India today. He's the first Israeli Prime Minister ever to visit India. Newspapers in India are calling this the most controversial state visit to the country since the Shah of Iran came in 1978. And there is a significant military component to the India-Israel relationship. The New York Times reporting Israeli munitions have proved particularly valuable for India as it tries to bulk up its conventional defenses against its nuclear-armed neighbor, Pakistan. Israel has supplied India with surface-to-air missiles, avionics, sophisticated sensors to monitor cross-border traffic, remotely piloted drones, and artillery. The United States and other restricted technology exports to India in response to its 1998 nuclear tests, making Israel's responsiveness U.S. all the more welcome in India. The Times says India and Israel are currently negotiating the transfer of three Falcon airborne early warning radar command and control systems with an estimated $1 billion price tag after the U.S. lifted its objection this year to the sale. We turn now to India, to C. Raja Mohan, who is strategic affairs editor of The Hindu and author of Crossing the Rubicon, The Shaping of India's New Foreign Policy, as well as Proful Bidway, who is a well-known anti-nuclear peace activist in India. C. Raja Mohan, I'd like to talk about two issues. But first, we were just listening to President Bush's speech last night. What this means for troops in India, do you believe they will be sent to Iraq if the UN authorizes a multinational force?
India had earlier committed itself by saying that if there is an explicit United Nations mandate, then India would reconsider its decision not to send troops in July. So India would wait and see how the debate in the UN would go and how far the UN involvement would take place. A second set of issues, I think, which will decide the Indian approach would be how quickly and how definitively is the US prepared to unveil a roadmap that would transfer the sovereignty back to the Iraqi people. So I think the Indian decision is an open one at this stage, and it would depend on how the UN approach, as well as the situation on the ground in terms of creating a framework for restoration, early restoration of sovereignty to the Iraqi people.
Proful Bidway, a former senior editor of the Times of India, your response to President Bush's speech and the possibility of Indian troops going to Iraq if that UN resolution is passed?
It seems to me that that's not enough, that there be a UN resolution. The Indian government's position is that there has to be an explicit mandate for a proper blue helmet United Nations peacekeeping force for India to participate in it. And it seems to me that it's very, very unlikely that the government of India, in spite of its wish, could change it, because the force of public opinion in this country is quite strong, and it's overwhelmingly opposed to sending troops to Iraq, because it, in the first place, it considered the war to be totally unjust and illegal and an insult to the United Nations, as well as to basic principles of justice and fairness. And I think, by and large, in the Indian public doesn't feel that India should help out the United States in continuing a what is the result of an unjust war, which is an unjust occupation. So it would be difficult under the circumstances. We have a bunch of elections to state legislatures coming up in 2 months' time. Under the circumstances, I think the government wouldn't want to risk taking a completely unpopular and highly controversial decision, and so it's unlikely to send troops. It's not enough that there be a new resolution in the Security Council. It must explicitly say that the command of the international or multilateral force be firmly in the hands of the United Nations and not in the hands of the United States.
C. Raja Mohan, your response.
No, I think the stated position of the government of India is that if there is a clear-cut UN mandate for the use of force for the stabilization, India would send troops. But of course, the question of domestic politics in an election year is important. But I think it would largely depend. I think it's not an open and it's not a clearly defined case. I would say the decision is open at this stage. If the UN resolution is reasonable, and that significant powers are transferred to the United Nations, and far more important, I would believe, in from my point of view, is that there is a, if there is a clear roadmap for the restoration, early restoration of the sovereignty to the Iraqi people, then I think, and if that sovereign body is going to ask India to come and help out, I would think the Indians would give it a second hearing.
We're also joined on the telephone from Islamabad by M. Ziauddin, who is the resident editor of The Dawn, the newspaper there. Can you talk about the response in Pakistan to the possibility of sending Pakistani troops to Iraq?
Well, I think it is out. I don't think the government is in a position, the government of Pervez Musharraf is in a position to accept the request from the U.S. to send troops.
And we're having trouble understanding you. You're actually breaking up. Can you repeat that last comment?
Yeah. General Musharraf is already in Afghanistan. And we have committed a lot of troops there. We are rather facing a hostile Afghanistan today. As everybody knows in Pakistan, this is a very unpopular situation for General Musharraf. And to send troops to Afghanistan to serve under the UN command would be like serving an occupation force. Would obviously create a situation where Muslims.
Your phone is breaking up. But before we lose you, M. Ziauddin, we'll try one last question, which involves the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, going to India. Your response in Pakistan?
Well, it is being looked with a lot of suspicion here. And we are already facing, India is considered and with the Israeli Prime Minister there, and the talk of sales of highly sophisticated weapons systems, I feel in this country as if the two Israel and India are joining hands to create a situation in the region which would accelerate an arms race in which Pakistan does not want to join. It cannot afford to join. And we are anxious about it. We are concerned about this visit.
M. Ziauddin, I want to thank you for being with us. Sorry for the phone problem. Resident editor of The Dawn in Pakistan. I want to go back to our guests in India to talk about this state visit. Advance team of Ariel Sharon has already arrived in India for this unprecedented three-day trip. Again, Sharon is the first Israeli prime minister ever to visit India. I'd like to start with you, Profil Bidway, about your response to this visit and the reasons for it.
Well, we in the peace movement and in general, the liberal left current of opinion in this country totally oppose this visit, not because we are against Israel or believe that the state of Israel is illegitimate, but because we feel that this is the wrong time for the government to invite a person like Sharon, who has launched the most aggressive offensive. It's actually a war against the Palestinian people. Along with the building of a huge barrier, this wall, which is going to be 650 kilometers long and 8 meters high. It's been called the apartheid wall. They've unleashed a policy of ruthless extermination of individuals whom they merely suspect to be terrorists. They call it targeted assassination. These are extrajudicial killings. This is state terrorism at work. It seems extremely unfortunate to us that Sharon should be here on the anniversary of September 11th, which is like a World Terrorism, Anti-Terrorism Day. By implication, the government of India wants to express its solidarity with what it regards as Israel's struggle against terrorism, which is common to India's struggle. Now, we reject that completely because I think what Sharon is fighting is a colonial occupation powers fight against terrorism, or as well as independence of the Palestinian people. Whereas India's problem of terrorism is completely different. It has nothing to do with occupation and colonization, which is totally against international law, which is against elementary principles of justice and morality. It is extremely unfortunate that this is the beginning of which emerges a very dangerous form of collaboration between the most extreme forces in three countries, namely the Hindu fundamentalists in India, the extreme Zionist fundamentalists in Israel, and the neoconservatives in the United States. So we see this as the thin end of the wedge. That's why there have been protests. There have been demonstrations in cities like Bombay. Already, they're scheduled to take place tomorrow in Delhi. We hope large numbers of people will turn up. The vast majority of India's political parties are extremely uncomfortable about this visit or have serious reservations and opposition to it. Even the Congress Party, which is the biggest party in the opposition, has expressed its dismay at the timing of the visit, except that Sonia Gandhi, party president, is going to follow strict protocol, and as has been the tradition, as the leader of the opposition, will call on the visiting head of state or head of government. But otherwise, no party, except for the right-wing Bharatiya Hindu chauvinist Bharatiya Janata Party, has any sympathy for this visit. This is a very parochial and sectarian agenda of just one group of people in the country. It has no broad-based support. There is no consensus. There is no moral or political mandate for doing this. And this is going to cause deep divisions in this society.
Let me ask you, Rajamohan, for your response, editor of The Hindu.
No, I think the governments cannot take the kind of attitude Mr. Praful Bidhu as an activist takes. And the fact is that India has established full diplomatic relations with the Israeli government 10 years ago, more than in 1992. Since then, every political party in India has had a shot at government. And the policy of engaging Israel has had consistent across-the-board political support of all the political parties in this country. Now, you don't choose the heads of state of other countries. So if Indo-Israeli relationship has grown significantly in the last 10 years, India was no longer in a position to deny a head of state visit to India. I mean, this is not the first unpopular leader from across the world that India is entertaining. India has entertained a lot of others in the past, many third world dictators, many communists, many socialists, you name it, of every stripe and color. So I don't think that is an issue. And the fact is, India has not changed its position on the question of rights and on the question of ending the occupation of the Palestinian territories. So the Indian position is consistent with its historical support of the Palestinian cause. And what India is doing is pragmatically engaging both sides. And I think that policy is very similar to the other major powers, whether it is the U.S., France, Russia, China, European Union, Japan. Everyone deals with both sides. So I don't think India is going to be burdened by an approach which is going to be completely rejecting the leadership of one side in a dispute.
And Praful Bidhu, the idea that was raised by the Pakistani guest of the accelerated arms race with the level of military sales that are going on between Israel and India, Israel able to sell technology to India at a time when the U.S. had sanctions against selling any kind of nuclear weapons either to India or Pakistan.
Well, it seems to be, yes. I think it's not just Israel, but the sales of any kind of advanced armaments to either India or Pakistan is deeply destabilizing. And certainly in the case of some of these advanced warning and control systems, AWACS, like the Falcon system that that Israel is planning to sell to India or almost finalized selling, will have deeply destabilizing effects, especially on the nuclear rivalry and these equations. And I think the Israelis, have played a certain role here, which has got the Pakistanis worried. But I think the more important question is really whether this particular strategic relationship that's growing between India and Israel is worthy of such a major policy shift. I completely disagree with Mr. Rajamohan when he says that India's policy on Palestine has not changed and it's consistent with the invitation to Sharon. That's simply not true. In fact, India has refused to help the Palestinian Authority in any way. The Palestinian foreign minister was here, just 10 days ago, and he made several requests to India, and India has refused to intervene and help in any way. It has, in fact, not even condemned the wall, which the United States has publicly expressed reservations about. I'm talking about the Super Berlin Wall or the apartheid wall that Sharon is building. It has refused to condemn Israel's policy of extrajudicial killings and so on and so forth. So it is a deep compromise, it seems to me, and it's not just a question of the right of a head of state or government to visit. It's a question of how you plan the visit, what significance you attach to it, why you invite them on the anniversary of September the 11th, why you talk about the special strategic alliance between India, Israel, and the United States to combat terrorism.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Profil Bidway, former senior editor of The Times of India, author of New Nukes, India, Pakistan, and Global Nuclear Disarmament, and C. Rajamohan, strategic affairs editor of The Hindu newspaper in India, and the book Crossing the Rubicon, The Shaping of India's New Foreign Policy. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we will talk about the resignation of Abu Mazen, Palestinian Prime Minister. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian Authority Chair Yasser Arafat yesterday picked Palestinian Legislative Council Speaker Ahmed Krea as the next PA Prime Minister, with a Fatah Central Committee meeting approving the appointment last night. Krea has been lobbying American European diplomats for the past few weeks, sounding them out about his replacing Mahmoud Abbas, who resigned as prime minister on Saturday. There was no immediate comment from either Washington or Jerusalem on Krea's appointment, which only becomes official after a vote of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Ahmed Krea was an architect of the 1993 Oslo Peace Accords. He was bypassed earlier this year when U.S., European, UN, and Russian representatives pushed Arafat to accept Abbas. Israeli officials have already indicated they may protest the appointment, saying he is too closely associated with Arafat. We turn now to two guests to respond to the latest news over the weekend. Tanya Reinhart is with us, professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University. She's author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. And we're also joined from Jordan by Muen Rabbani, who is a Middle East expert. Welcome to Democracy Now! Both. Muen Rabbani, your reaction to the resignation of Mahmoud Abbas.
Well, I'm tempted to say that Abbas dug his own grave and then fell into it. If you look at the reasons he gave for his resignations, he said he was lied to by Israel, betrayed by the United States, and sabotaged by President Arafat. Now, the question that arises is, why did he believe either Israel or the United States without receiving any firm guarantees that they would actually do what they said they would, namely that Israel would alleviate the conditions of life of the Palestinians, and that if they didn't do so, that the United States would exert pressure on Israel to do so. He took it all on faith and fell flat on his face for doing so.
Can you talk about who the new prime minister is? Can you talk about Ahmed Correa?
Well, he was the chief negotiator of the 1993 Oslo Accords, and now he's basically going to become prime minister in a new peace agreement that reproduces all the mistakes of the Oslo Accords. I mean, while there's certainly blame enough to go around for the, you know, for the recent resignation of Abbas, I think ultimately it's a structural problem that the parties adopted an unworkable peace agreement and quite naturally failed to implement it. Although I have to say, in comparison with Mahmoud Abbas, Ahmed Correa seems to have learned some lessons, because he's now stated very clearly that unless he receives firm guarantees from all the parties concerned, chiefly Israel and the United States, but also the Palestinian president, that he will be able to succeed. He's not going to accept the position of Palestinian prime minister.
Correa is the one who won recognition for secret talks with Israel that led to the 1993 famous handshake on the White House lawn between Yasser Arafat and Israel's Yitzhak Rabin.
He was the chief negotiator in Oslo at the time, and the so-called architect of those talks, the one who controlled them from the PLO headquarters in Tunis, was Mahmoud Abbas, the former prime minister who was around for the last 100 days. So there's very little difference between their political outlook and their programs. And I should say also there's fairly little difference between these two and Arafat. I think the main problem that you had between Mahmoud Abbas and Yasser Arafat was not so much their political program, but the main problem was really the context in which they were interacting, in which Israel and the United States, and to a lesser extent also the other members of the quartet, made it very clear that Abbas's main responsibility is to seize power from Arafat and remove him from the political scene. Obviously, Arafat had no intention of being the chief actor in a coup against himself, and once that he sensed that there could be a real threat to his power, went about and sabotaged Abbas's position, which was made very easy because he had nothing to show for his rule already as a result of Israeli intransigence and the Bush administration fiddling while the Middle East burned.
Why did the UN, US, Europe, and Russia representatives push Arafat to accept Abbas over Correa?
At the time, it was, you know, he was seen as the best candidate for the job because of statements that he'd made in the past several years opposing the militarization of the Palestinian uprising, calling for unconditional and unqualified Palestinian acceptance of the roadmap and all kinds of unilateral Palestinian concessions to Israel as a means of getting a peace process back on track. But really, he was seen as the most suitable candidate in that respect by both Israel and the United States. A big part of it also that they felt that he could be a genuine rival to Arafat and ultimately displace and replace him. And I think it basically came down to that. But if you're talking about, you know, did he present a very different political line than other candidates at the time, like Ahmed Correa, I would say no. There's very little daylight between them.
Do you think that Yasser Arafat is in danger of being assassinated?
Well, I think he's been in danger of being assassinated now for at least a year and a half. And when you hear Colin Powell, for example, yesterday on the Sunday talk show saying that he doesn't support such a move now, basically neither Israel nor the Palestinians take U.S. policy very seriously when it's expressed by the Secretary of State, because both of them feel that the real power in Washington lies elsewhere. I think also the speed with which Arafat and the Central Committee of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, Fatah, and the Executive Committee of the PLO moved to appoint a new prime minister also shows, I think, anxiety from their part that if they don't establish a new government very soon, that there would be this kind of window of opportunity through which the increasingly bloody struggle between Israel and Hamas could have direct consequences for both the Palestinian Authority and for its elected president.
Mouin Rabbani speaking to us from Jordan. Tanya Reinhart, you're author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948 at Tel Aviv University and University of Utrecht. Can you respond to the resignation? Were you surprised by it? What does this mean for the Middle East right now?
Well, if we take the words of Abbas himself when he resigned, he put the blame on Israel, and the fact is that he was never given any chance or, let's say, the roadmap that he was supposed to be responsible to, and as Rabbani said, he attached faith and belief to, and never had any chance to begin with. One thing that is completely forgotten is that the roadmap, the little content that the roadmap plan had, was that Israel should withdraw immediately at the first phase to the lines of September 2000, namely the lines it held at the beginning of the Palestinian uprising. Israel never accepted this claim, and they said so clearly, which never bothered anybody in the U.S. media to describe Israel as the side who that accepted the roadmap. Instead, Israel announced that it would do something to ease the conditions of life in the occupied territories. In practice, not even that has happened. Out of the, there are about 200 roadblocks in the West Bank, out of which Israel lifted five. So the rest, everything continues exactly as it was before the ceasefire. People are dying there, because they can't cross the roadblock to get, if someone gets a heart attack, he can't get to the hospital. There is economical strangulation of the territories. And Israel is continuing to build the wall, which in practice, according to the plans, is going to annex 40% of the West Bank to Israel. So Israel's measures were continued just like there is no ceasefire. And under these conditions, obviously, Abbas did not have any chance to get to organize the Palestinian society.
Well, Tanya Reinhart, I want to thank you, too, for being with us, author of Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. That does it for the program. Our website, democracynow.org. You can get a copy of the show, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.